Ladies and gentlemen,
are you ready for the big show?
Are you ready?
You ready for the buzzer?
Go! This is the MLS Show. On the BTP Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond the Pitch's MLS Show. My name is Scott Nichols, your host, and I'm joined today with country music star Kenny Foster, who is on tour in the UK and Ireland. Kenny, how's it going?
Oh, it continues to go well, my friend.
Nice, nice. How's the UK been treating you? How's it been treating you in country music?
So good. You have great listeners over here. There's people that just love music and love to listen, and that means a great deal to me. So it's been a lot of fun, man.
Yeah, just traveling. So you've traveled to the UK before for yes. just leisure, right?
Sure, and but, actually to play a bit of footy when I was younger.
Yeah, exactly. See, I wanted to touch on that too.
we will.
But okay, so what's been your favorite part of the tour so far? Let's just start there. What has been the favorite part apart from this interview, of course?
Of course, you know, right? No, this is number one. Everything else pales in comparison. God, there's been a lot of highlights. I've really enjoyed the beauty of Ireland. Driving up the coast was pretty awesome.
Both
Dingle and in the north, but the show in Harrogate with that under the apple tree was insane. And today going to Hotspur Way was pretty insane. So
yeah, yeah.
It's been an incredible tour, man. I need to come back maybe like tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. We'd love to have you
there.
Back. Please do. Yeah.
Thank you, man. No. It's great.
So look, guys, if you're listening and you recognize the name Kenny Foster, you might have heard that Kenny just mentioned how he went to Tottenham today. It's probably because you saw a viral video of Kenny playing to the Tottenham Hotspur team in Nashville when they're on the preseason tour. So just tell me how on earth that came about. Like, how does that happen?
Sure. How does it happen? I don't know myself. No. So they were coming to Nashville, which is insane in and of itself. And I'm part of the supporters club in Nashville, Nashville Spurs.
Right.
We needed to blow it out because we knew people were going to come from all over the country, specifically to Nashville, to take care of all of the fans and the team as best we could. They usually have something called a Legends Night as part of their American tours. And so we knew we were going to be putting that on. But also I didn't think they were going to find a country musician in Nashville that knew as much about the Premier League, specifically one of the teams that was coming to play, as much as myself. And so my team sent on my information to Spurs, because we were in contact anyway, about if I could sing the anthem for the game, because
wow.
I thought that'd be a great gig.
Yeah, right.
And I didn't get it.
Oh.
Spurs didn't really have a say on it. They had City as well, and the stadium I think ultimately made the decision, and it was not me. But Spurs came along after the fact and said, look, we couldn't work out the anthem, but do you think you'd want to sing the team dinner? I said, well, I'll check my schedule.
I think I might be able to do that.
Let me think about it. And so I didn't sleep for a week, trying to prepare. It's like the hardest gig on God's green earth, I mean, playing for tens of thousands is fine. You just got bright lights in your face and you do your thing. It's not a thing. But when you can visibly see the people that you watch every week in front of you, and you desperately want them to enjoy themselves.
Yeah, there's Harry Kane just nodding his head
sure.
along to stand.
Sure.
You know, great.
Dude, on his Instagram story. It was unbelievable. So
really?
Well, we couldn't tell anybody about that night leading up, discretion, including like my best friends in the supporters club. So I didn't want him to feel betrayed by any stretch of the imagination, but I couldn't tell him that it was going to happen or where it was or any of those sorts of things. And so, yeah, the way that they all found out was people start at the get together. There was a Thursday night get together before the match of all the people that came into town, the supporters clubs. They saw it on Deli's Instagram, on Christian's Instagram, on Harry's, like me playing music. And they were like, wait, is that Kenny? And everyone just started freaking out. It was just a great weekend, man. It really was.
That's so funny. That's so great, though. It's awesome that they did that for you.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Look, we'll get onto soccer in just a second.
Sure.
Because look, we're here today as well to talk about you have this new album out now. Just before we even get onto that, you're from a place called Joplin, Missouri.
I am.
Right, little tiny town.
Yeah.
I think I've read in interviews before you said it's barely even on a map.
Well, it's funny because it's there. it's small for the States.
Right.
But like I went to Ireland and I'm like, yeah, there's really only about 40,000 people. And they're like, 40,000, you know? So, I mean, I realize it's all relative, but yeah, it was a small town. It was a wonderful place to grow.
Small
up.
Town. And people might have seen, they might be more familiar with the video for Hometown.
Yes,
you wrote
of
about your hometown, mm-hmm. that song, because it was largely destroyed by a storm, tornado?
Yeah, a tornado.
Tornado in 2011. So just talk to us real quick, because this sort of leads me into the next thing I want to ask you about the album.
Sure.
Just how was that writing that song? Was it difficult? Like, to take us through the sort of emotions that you went through.
Well, it wasn't difficult, actually. It came rather easily in the fact that the story in that song is my family's story. It is my family's tornado story. So it was really just gathering that. I wanted to go down immediately. I was in Nashville at the time that the storm hit, and we lost everything that we owned, my childhood home, and it was 12 miles long and a mile wide, and so we were right in the middle of the zone, right across from the high school that I attended.
Yeah,
and So Joplin has very much been a part of my story, and I was so thankful that my family was okay. They rode the storm out in their crawl space, and the house itself got scraped off its foundation, and they listened to it over their heads while everything that they had ever owned and accumulated swept into the night, and they heard it. And I can't imagine what that was like to go through.
Yeah.
And so trying to put myself in their shoes as to what they must be feeling. I knew there was enough heartbreak to go around, and what I decided to do, rather than a song of lament, was to write a song of encouragement and hope, and the thing that we needed most probably at that time. I didn't realize that's what we needed. It was really for me. I needed to convince myself that everything was going to be okay. And the response from them, from the city, from my parents, from the original family friend that videoed it on their phone, that sort of begat the whole thing. I loved that it connected, and I realized that in real situations, the right words can make the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, and you're right, it's that connection and it's words that make that, especially music in general. And there's so much feeling, I think, in your music from listening to Deep Cuts, from listening to the EPs that you've put out as well, and the songs Hometown. You know, I think that's why I gravitate towards it so much as an album, I would say. And it's just so, so beautifully written. But look, what was the process of putting it together like?
It was insane.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, this is the record of my life. And I had 450 songs to choose from for this record. And they all had to mesh. They all had to fit correctly, cohesively. I wrote a lot of great songs that didn't make this record. And it was because they weren't the tone. This was really my first full-length album to define myself. I think in Nashville and in the business of it, sometimes you get caught up in waiting for somebody else to give you the green light. And I decided to take the green light for myself and make a record that was exactly what I wanted before anybody else got a voice in it. So it was picking the best songs in a particular tone with this record, and finding the project name, and the artwork, of course, went into it. And it just became the thing that I always wanted to do. When I imagined as a child growing up and making a record, we went into a proper studio, we had proper players, I got to do my thing. We had a great producer that just knew how to bring songs out of me. And it's how I'd always dreamed of making a record, and I got to do it. And I think it's just a phenomenal feeling.
I feel like a lot of people don't necessarily get that privilege, right, to make a record that they necessarily want to do. Now, is that typical? Like, just going back to the 450 songs that you had to whittle through, is that typical of somebody who lives and works in Nashville that you write that many songs, or is this just a Kenny Foster thing?
Well, no, it depends on what they do. There are guys that are turning in 200 to 300 songs a year, years in a row. I mean, that's their job every day, publishing houses and writing for other artists and never intending to put them out as an artist themselves. And honestly, on some of the path, the first 2 years of that proficient period for me was I was writing for other people. I was trying to find homes for the songs that I was writing, and they couldn't really find one. There wasn't a home that existed for this voice in country music as they knew it. I don't know how many publishers said, that's a great song. I don't know who's going to cut it. And every time I had a meeting that said something like that, whatever song was just played, made a mental note, put it in my back pocket. And until I accumulated enough of those and I said, I have a pile full of songs that have no home, but have been recognized by people who listen to songs every day as great. So why is there no home for it? We need to create one. And so Deep Cuts was mine. It was just the assembly of all of these tunes that didn't have the single that you'd point to pull it in. Like, I want any song on this record to be able to stand on its own as not only an artist record, but a really palatable, understandable, relatable song.
Yeah, so let's just talk about Deep Cuts a bit, because usually the quote deep cuts,
sure,
they're the sort of tracks that don't always stand out on first listen necessarily, sure, but they sort of tell the story, for me at least, of the art of the artist, of what they're trying to create, you know. Absolutely. Portray. Absolutely. For me anyway. So I think this selection of, you know, deep cuts, like, you know, you've called the album, is actually kind of the opposite, because I think it still maintains an artistic integrity, and they all stand out as like real good country songs, you know. Great. And you know, like, how did you manage to keep that that artistic integrity in the and the art of it there with the deep cuts, but also sort of meld that with, hey, this is a really great country song for radio too? How'd you do that?
Thank you for that question. I don't know. I think there was a large swath of my songwriting period that I was trying to write for radio. But in the manner with which radio was taking songs at the time, I was writing so far outside of myself. So I understood the formula, and I understood the hooks, and I understood what people were looking for radio, and how to turn a phrase and how to write to a hook. And so I learned a lot of tools for the trade, but they weren't necessarily my story, and I could feel that. And the fact that publishers weren't necessarily picking up on that helped me realize, you know, maybe I'm down the wrong path for me. Because there are plenty of guys in Nashville writing those tunes because that's them. That's their life. And it can't be diminished and it can't be written off. But I knew it wasn't mine. And even trying to fake it in a sea of people whose story that is was not going to go well. And so I now had all of these tools of how to write a great radio-ready country song. And I had my own story to add to it. And I have great co-writer friends that knew my story or heard my story, or in some cases we were writing for someone else, but I was so overtaken by the subject matter that we were on that I sort of started injecting more and more of myself into it, until it became such an artist song that it had to be mine, sort of, in a way. And so, yeah, my favorite cuts were the deep cuts. I loved track 12, 13, 14. I loved those because once the label got what they wanted and needed, those were the songs for the artist. And what I wanted to do was somehow, I mean, I don't even know how to write any other way now. I don't. Right. So I'm glad that you think that they're radio ready, palatable country songs. I love that you feel that way. I don't even think of them in that manner anymore. It's just a song that I wrote. Yeah, but it also came from my heart. And so maybe by like going way one direction, having come from another direction, when they smash into the middle, maybe it's just time. Maybe it's time for radio ready songs to have a heart as well that came from the artist themselves.
I think that all depends on the person who's singing the words as well, right? You know, I think that always depends on that. Look, what was your favorite song to write and to
from
record,
the record?
From the record and to record it, just the most fun you had recording it. Maybe not the best one that you think is the best one, but your favorite one. And also, what was the one that gave you the most trouble? Like, you were up in the late night sleeping, just going, I can't, how do I finish this one? You know, there's always one, you know.
From the writing or the recording standpoint?
Let's go with the recording standpoint.
My favorite one to record was Good Old Days. The tones that Steve, the guitar player, Steve Mason, came out with when we started playing with that, because he also played the baritone guitar on it as well.
Nice.
Which just added a new element of depth. I had always sort of been in love with this musical landscape and these very true lyrics to punch through this otherwise very sonic You know, it's like a bed, like a hammock you can lay in. But then to say some pretty poignant things amidst this otherwise very chill, groovy, ethereal sound, to hear that come through the monitors in the studio. Because I did a guitar vocal, and then the band came in, and then I went in and redid the guitar vocal on top, having had the band underneath me. And so it allowed for expression on both ends, you know, one to be true to how I wrote it, just guitar vocal me. But then once the band came in, then I was moved by a different set of rules. So I wasn't like paying homage to the song as it was written. I was now paying an homage to what it had become. And that gave a different performance vocally for me.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so when Steve got to that guitar solo in the middle of Good Old Days, I remember he played so many different things, and we ran over a few tracks, and eventually I just leaned in, and on the talk back I sang him the line that I wanted him to play, and then to hear him play that, you know, note for note right back at me, it was just this magical moment, because Steve was a member of a band that I loved growing up. It was a band called Jars of Clay, and he was the guitarist and original lead vocalist of that band, and to have him play on my record was this very full circle moment, and to sort of see the music being paid forward as we moved, I don't know, it was just really, really beautiful. And that was the moment that it really caught me. So that would have been the favorite. I had a really hard time with Old Fashioned. Old Fashioned started as a really upbeat, kind of straightforward, almost good enough kind of feel.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is funny, because that song, actually, I was just sitting in Starbucks just down the street, and that was the last song that came through before I was like, okay, gotta go now, you know.
Sure.
And it just, it feels really natural the way it is.
I know. How weird, right?
Right, yeah. But that was the one that gave you the most trouble.
Well, it did, just because Mitch, the producer, Mitch Dain, did a wonderful job of
keeping you on.
Zhuzhing that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. To the point that when we went into the studio, I took care of all of the lick portions of that song, and he was in there strumming his Gibson with the chord structure. And because it was, I mean, we were even changing chord structure in the middle of it just to try to figure out how to capture this sort of like folky Americana vibe that I loved, but I don't naturally draw myself to. Mm-hmm. And so that's what made it so difficult for me. But then once we found that groove, I just loved the way, he would say he's not a guitar player, but just the kind of messy little strums that he put together. I'm like, that's exactly what it needs though. I would almost be too perfect on it. And so this lazy little guitar groove that he laid down that allowed me to sort of put the licks on top of it and have, it ended up, I love it, and to be honest, it's a lot of people's favorites.
Yeah, no, it's great. It is a great song.
There's a lot of different favorites on the record, though. Everyone's is different.
Good Enough, I think, is my favorite.
Oh, cool.
I think Good Enough's my favorite. But look, we're on the last night of the tour. Go home tomorrow. Sad times.
Stop reminding me.
Look, now you've been here, you've been around the country, been around Ireland. What do you make of the country music scene here and in Ireland? Like, did you sort of, were you expecting it? Because I certainly wasn't. Look, I came over from America. I've been 6 years in America. Went to college in Pennsylvania, lived in Houston, then to Cape Cod, then home. And I just loved country music because I was in America. I've been to Nashville. I got this tattoo right here in Nashville. Nice. Like, you know, so like, I love it. But then I came back and just thought that nobody else liked it. And all of a sudden, everyone was like, no, I love country music. So how did you find that?
Well, I was told to be prepared for it, but I had no idea it would be like this.
Quite how much?
Sure. Well, and to be honest, I guess you realize at some point that fans of people like country music because it's real, because it's story-driven and it's genuine. And if you hear anything that's real, if it's outside of your sphere of influence, like, you're drawn to it because, I mean, there's art and films and characters in movies that I don't agree with any of the things that they're doing, but I can tell the actor has done it so convincingly that I know that character and I can at least relate to him in some way, shape, or form. And I think country music does that. And certainly it can't be recreated in a country that hadn't birthed the music in the first place. Right. And so, I mean, I know in Harrogate, Roy Webber was sort of like, look, you can't we can't fake that. Like, the only place to get that from is the States. And so I think there's been, I think the show Nashville has helped, like, turn people's ear towards
I've
it.
I've just started watching that, and it is just, I watch it more for the music than anything.
Sure.
Because they must have publishing houses writing these songs for them.
For Sync, yes, of course. Of course they do. I've got friends with, yes.
Nice.
It's all there.
Yeah.
But I also think that maybe it's the combination of it being so, so genuine, so earnest. I love that word. And also that you can't get it here. And so there's something a bit exotic about it.
Right.
You know, I mean, honestly, it's probably why I was into soccer so hard when I was growing up, because
it was something that you didn't really get. Well, let's talk about that, because we're, look, this is also what we're here to talk about, because you are a huge soccer fan, and you were, I'm led to believe, a soccer player.
Oh, yes.
As well. But I didn't realize quite to what level at the time, so tell us about that real quick. So you ended up playing over here for the U.S. Olympic Development Team?
Well, the Olympic Development Program wasn't what came over, wasn't what brought me here in the first place.
Okay.
I came over with British soccer camps. I used to put these tours on, and they would come to my small little town. And these funny talking guys that just could play out of their heads, you know, showed us what was what. And that was always fascinating to me. And so I went on one of their tours. But then when I got back, I was doing traveling soccer from a young age. But it's different in the States, as you know. It's almost like pay to play instead of being invested in.
It's actually a big thing right now within soccer is pay to play. And that's hurting the quality of the national team.
It is.
Stuff like that.
It is. Yeah. Well, because...
So how did your family combat that? Just living in small town Joplin, Missouri, and you're on a travel soccer team with pay to play. Like, how does that affect a family and your dreams as being a soccer player?
Yeah, that's a great question. We started our own travel soccer team. Like, there's this small community of people that came out of these British soccer camps that were like, so we had a coach, and everyone kind of pooled their money together, and we started entering regional competitions. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing. You know, I mean, nobody really did, but it was something we all wanted more than anything. And so there was this sort of can-do attitude, and we were terrible, you know. And we didn't have enough players to fill an age group. So everyone was in one age group. We were playing U13, and I was 9 years old. And the difference between a 9-year-old and a 13-year-old, you
can
tell me.
Significant, right?
Sure. So I played U13 for 4 years. You know, until I finally grew into it. But then it was gangbusters because I'd been walloped, you know, for so many years.
Right, and
so,
and then you were doing the walloping after that.
Well, I mean, a bit. I knew how to ripple a net, that's all.
Yeah, definitely. So what was your position when you played?
Well, it depended on
what
the game called for.
Right,
Yeah, mostly striker. But then I ended up in central midfield during the formative years of high school. And then university, I moved into a defensive central mid. But yeah, I liked... playmaking.
Like
that was
a
Moussa really
Dembele kind of.
Sure, and Eriksen.
Eriksen as
cases.
Well. Oh,
yeah.
Like a deep lying playmaker.
Exactly.
There you go. See, with your flowing hair, I can imagine it. There you go. Through
in
the
wind.
Of,
yes.
There you go, right? Yeah. So, it's. You went to. You actually ended up at Belmont, which is a D1 school for soccer.
Yes, it is.
So, yeah, you were not a bad player. Like, you said that you guys weren't very good, but you must have been good to be playing D1.
Well, once we got to the Olympic Development Program, I mean, I made the Missouri's Midwest team.
Okay.
First 3 years in high school.
Right.
My senior year, I don't want to get into that story. It's quite heartbreaking.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I felt like I was a victim of. Bit political game there, and so as
that
you
happens
know,
even at the youth levels of soccer over here, I can tell you.
I'm sure that's true.
Trust
me. Oh no.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's a story for later.
That's a story
will
for
you
later.
Tell me.
I will. Yeah.
Okay. Great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So then it was that, and so honestly, I was so turned off by it there my senior year in high school that I didn't even play university. So I went to Missouri State University and just did music.
Oh.
That's all I did. I did music at a cappella group. And I started a band. Yeah, all of the things that you do in college. And it was such a blast. And that's ultimately what brought me to Nashville.
Right.
But then when I went to Nashville. I transferred schools to Belmont right. and then walked on to the team. So
oh, cool.
That's how I ended up at Belmont playing.
There you go. Yeah, excellent. And I just read they tied with Dayton this weekend.
Oh, really?
There you go. On Sunday.
Dude, good for them.
There you go. See, I don't know how good Dayton is, but I know that they're in the Horizon League. I've been looking this up, you see. I knew it was coming.
Look, well, we used to be in the A-Sun, man. It was
Atlantic
way
Sun.
Back in the
yeah,
day.
I think they're actually a different conference now for yeah. every other sport, and it's just Horizon for soccer,
yep,
apparently.
I believe that.
So anyway, look, we talked at the top of the podcast about you being a Tottenham fan very briefly.
Yes.
You know, so what was... Look, I always ask this of people,
sure.
you know, what was the moment that you were like, you know what, I'm a Tottenham Hotspur fan for life? How did that come about?
It's funny, right?
Yeah.
To be honest, the moment that probably cemented it for me is my wife bought me a jersey for Christmas.
Oh.
Probably six, 7 years ago was probably the moment when I was like, all right.
That's it.
Done and dusted. But we had... So, there's a... mid-10 EPL fan page on Facebook I was invited to years ago, and it was all of the supporters, a lot of expats from here mm-hmm. living in the States and wanted to sort of feel that camaraderie again, and so they started all these supporters groups, but they weren't big enough to have their own pubs, so they all supported from the same pub, which you would never see over here.
No, not once.
Ever, not even a little bit.
Nope.
So I got to learn all the rivalries and the banter and the histories of all these clubs, and got to meet people that were lifelong fans of these clubs. And to be honest, the ones that I related to most, the ones that I felt, they had a bit of an underdog about them. They had a bit of, even when things were going bad, they had songs for that,
mm.
you know, like a bit
yeah.
of gallows humor to them. And
yeah.
I can certainly relate to that. I was from a small town, and I've supported non-championship winning teams for years and years and years. So it's not necessary for me to need that. And, I know that there's a bunch of folks over here that come over and they decide to be NFL fans, and they're like, well, Patriots,
yeah,
Cowboys, Steelers, and it's like, well, of course, you know, Yankees, Reds, you know,
yeah.
yeah. So
guilty.
Well, sure, but I just something in me knew enough about that to say that can't be it, and
yeah.
there was something really special about this underdog story that never really gets the plaudits, and I certainly understand that from my own personal professional career, and so I certainly saw an underdog, and I knew that the moment that they came good, everyone would jump on the bandwagon, but I wasn't going to be a bandwagon fan. I saw the come upping, and I wanted to be in on the ground floor, and that was about as ground as I could get.
Probably at that time. If, unless it was Everton, of course, which are another team close to my heart.
Oh,
my best friend is an Everton fan. I'm actually going to the game on Saturday against Tottenham.
Oh.
Would you believe? I'll be in the Gladys Street end. I will be, yeah.
Okay,
that's
well,
true, because my friend Adam is getting married and he can't go. He said, I'm probably not going to, you know, go to the game the night after I'm married. So
he well, said it's the night after.
Exactly, I know.
Come
See,
on.
That's what I said, but I'm going with his dad, Big John, so we're going to go there.
That's going to be great.
So look, I saw recently on Instagram there, on your Instagram, that you went to see Tottenham play at Wembley, which must have been huge.
Oh my gosh, you
for
have
a
no
lifelong,
idea.
Well, I say a life, yeah, a long time Tottenham fan for you.
Sure.
You know, what do you make of this Wembley curse that they seem to have? You know, do you think that it's a legitimate thing? Is it... Because obviously you must be used to playing to a certain venue or in a certain place.
Sure.
You're used to playing in Nashville. You know, you have almost, let's say, a home field advantage there. But if
sure.
you go out, it can be a little bit different and things can get a little bit, you know, stranger than what you're used to. You think that's what's happening here with Tottenham? Do you think that this is a legitimate thing? Do you think you can turn it around?
Let me preface the whole thing by saying it's not legitimate. I just think curses are just something
silly
for the media to talk
right,
about.
Yeah.
And just another way to try to put Tottenham down because everyone's scared.
Right.
Where it is with me at some point is yes, it's a larger field than we're used to.
Mm.
And you need to consider that some of the teams that are coming up have never played in the National Stadium before.
Right.
And so they're up for this game.
Mm-hmm.
All they want to do is play in front of 70,000 plus.
At Wembley,
at the National Stadium. I mean, I remember as a kid without a Premier League team to my name, my dad brought me over when I was 18 and we toured Old Wembley. And so I've done the thing and I've touched the cup
mm-hmm.
and like, you know, paid the money and bought
yeah,
the
yeah,
t-shirt.
Yeah.
And so to go to the new one is... It's intimidating. I mean, when we walked out,
yeah.
when you walk out and see the mass of it. But they're all on the side of Spurs, I think. Yeah. I mean, cause this can go really deep, man. I almost want the transfer window to sort of be solidified before the season starts, and I think you'll see a bit less of it. Yeah. You'll see a bit less of a slow start, and we've always been slow starters, so it hasn't really bothered me. The onset, yeah. I mean, look, it's a thing. If it puts people in the papers talking, then that's fine. They can do their thing. But I'm really not worried about it. It's really the difference of just a few square meters, to be honest.
I think my personal feeling is that they'll get it.
Of course they
together
will.
Eventually.
Well, and then be afraid because everyone's forgotten in this silly season. They've forgotten how hard we were clicking. Even away at the end of last season, and we lost none of those players.
You can tell that there's that togetherness there, can't you? From when you were playing for the team.
Completely.
You can tell that there's a big togetherness there.
And without question.
That sort of togetherness is beget by the fact that they're not necessarily that active in the transfer window, but you have made some additions, right?
Of course.
Serge Aurier.
Especially towards the end.
Fernando Llorente.
Sanchez.
You know, Davinson Sanchez too. Mm-hmm. So you've strengthened an already really strong backline.
And
now
Foyth
you
as
have.
Well.
Sorry?
Foyth as well.
Yeah, Foyth as well. No, yeah, Foyth as well, exactly. So you've already strengthened that defence, and you've added this extra option between Janssen and Kane
up top
now. Look, do you think that maybe this is the way forward for some Premier League teams, that Pochettino can take these guys and really guide them to the top of the table? Or do you think that, you know, they maybe need to start spending a bit more money on some like really big superstar kind of players like the likes of Chelsea, Man City, Liverpool kind of do?
Sure. I am a large fan of building something rather than buying it. And so I am going to always side with the team that's trying to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens that that's my club.
I was going to say. Yeah.
So I understand. I mean, Levy said it himself that this sort of spending is unsustainable. And I believe that it is. And if these teams didn't go spend $250 million in the transfer window, real question, where would they be? And the thing is, we didn't have to, and where are we?
Right.
Now, of course, the proof will be in the pudding at the end of the day, but I think that keeping two players that on the world markets are valued over 150 mil, like, that should be worth something.
Right.
Like, yes, we could have gone and purchased them, but also they didn't go away. And so you have players that seem happy and settled, and you have a manager, a gaffer, who is, without question, He's a fantastic manager.
Mm.
He is a father figure to some of these guys. And to see how he's brought together not just the players but the coaching staff. I mean, people that have been working for Spurs through 10 different managers at this point,
right,
know that something special is happening there. And they're in the middle of it. And that says something to me.
So just real quick, because, you know, we've run a long time, but that's okay. I'm just
sorry. Yeah, yeah.
No. We're running. But like, what's your favorite memory of Spurs? Your favorite sport? Obviously, the team dinner in Nashville is going to be a big one.
Sure. I mean, God.
I don't think you can beat that.
You can't.
But
give me
your favorite sporting memory of Tottenham Hotspur football club so far.
Harry's second goal in the NLD.
NLDS. Listen to you.
Yeah. Come on now. off the post from an impossible angle with that silly mask on. Like, I'll just never forget.
Never forget the look
on his face and how even our pub was going nuts across the pond. Like,
yeah.
It's just, I don't know. It's stuff dreams are made of.
Do you think there's not really another game like soccer that can sort of give you these feelings and these moments, I don't truly believe.
Well, the other ones are a bit start-stop, right?
Right.
You know, at least the American sports are. Mm. And it's because it's such a free-flowing game, you have to pay attention the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fans are in it as much as the players. It's not just like, oh, we've got three plays to go grab a hot dog. It's like, no, halftime, get your pie and come back. Like, that's it. And so everyone is in tune. And so there's this emotion. Probably the only sport that I can think of I've been to that gets close is hockey. In that it's free-flowing, you know, no starts and stops. And it's really up to the players. And you're sort of willing them to do something great. And there's just a sensation about it that's not, you know, and now do something great. It's like, no, do something great over and over and over again until it works.
All the time.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And do it while constantly moving.
Please. Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's exactly. The other thing, right? So just real quick, favorite player, past or present?
Oh, God. I mean, I don't know who wouldn't be a Kane fan right now.
Sure.
Modric was a pretty phenomenal right. player.
Yeah.
I mean, Bale was a good player. Still is. You know, yeah. they're all, they, I mean, yeah. they all are. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to think it was Baggio. I was
Know, yes, Roberto Baggio. Yeah.
Until the World Cup moment that will live in infamy where he sailed one over the bar.
In the US,
yeah. Yes, that there was tough.
Do you know what? That's my one of my earliest football memories. I was born in 1988. Imagine that. 1988. I was born in 98. Remember watching in our first house that we lived in, I think.
Sure.
That game, that World Cup final on the television, but I barely remember it. All I remember is Baggio missing that penalty.
Yep. That's all I remember. All you're going to remember.
That's all I'll ever remember.
There Sadly enough.
That is the thing. So look, to finish.
Sure, finish it all up.
What we're going to do is I've prepared a little Tottenham Hotspur quiz for you.
Oh God!
See now, look, you know, we'll see, we'll see how it goes. All right. So look, I'm just 10 real quick questions. All right.
Okay.
Okay. Kenny Foster, how many times have Tottenham won the FA Cup? Is it 7, 8, or 5?
7.
It's actually 8.
Is it?
It's 8.
But 7 times they won the cup and number 8 is coming up.
Exactly.
We're a hot shot, Tottenham.
There you go.
I thought
No, I think it's 8 times. 8 times we've won the FA Cup. But that's okay. Don't worry. It's okay. This is a really difficult question, this one. I've made the multiple choice just to, you know, because I put these together. So, and I'm a Chelsea fan, just in case you guys have forgotten. So I'm just trying to get a win. for that game at Stamford Bridge last season, or actually no, it was at White Hart Lane, 2-0 that you beat. So,
sorry about that.
Yeah, I know. See,
you at least got your 2-2 draw out of the deal.
We did. Yeah. We did. We needed that. Sorry about that. That may have cost you something like a league championship or something.
It might have.
Anyway. All right. Do you know what? I'm not gonna say. So, okay, who has more league goals for Tottenham? Is it Harry Kane, Gareth Bale, or Robbie Keane?
Oh God. So Harry's at 99. It's not Bale. I think it's Keno.
It is Keno. There you go. Circle gets the square. There you are. All right. Okay. Another fairly recent piece of knowledge for you. So let's, you know, see if we can keep these right answers rolling. Okay. Who is Tottenham's club record signing? Is it Davinson Sanchez, Moussa Sissoko, or Eric Lamela?
I think Sanchez just broke it.
Davinson Sanchez. Absolutely. Yeah. It was Moussa Sissoko.
It was Moussa, and then it was...
Lamella's Lamella not far behind that. Him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Lamella, and there's another guy. It's not just a couple mil stacking it up. Yeah, it's not that far.
Well, adjust for inflation, I guess we'll see.
Yeah,
it was probably shearing him then.
I know, right? Yeah, I know. Yeah, if you adjust for inflation, crikey, I wouldn't even want to think. You'd hope that he was worth it. Better, anyway, look. So, which of these three managers has a better winning percentage for Tottenham Hotspur Football Club?
Oh God,
is it Tim Sherwood, Andre Villas Boas, or Mauricio Pochettino?
God, don't do this to me.
They're very close.
Well, I know they're close.
So I'm not gonna.
It's not AVB. It is AVB. Are you kidding me? No,
it's AVB. It's AVB. 55%.
That's unbelievable.
55%. And yet, I think you would agree. So I think Pochettino's a better manager.
Yes.
I think he's a much better manager. He's only at 53, so don't worry. You're not far behind. But
Yeah. We got a little bit of time. It was all those draws mid-season.
There you go. Okay. So, last question.
You need a longer timeline as well.
That is a longer timeline. So, I know. It's a little bit. It's bigger. So, I just figured that, you know, I would put there. So, look, last question.
Okay.
That we'll do for this, okay?
All right.
Which football league team did Spurs sign Dele Alli from? Was it Brentford?
MK Dons.
There you go. He doesn't even need the things. There you go. Milton Keynes Dons. And it was £5 million. There you go. Look, Kenny, thank you so much for joining me today and giving me the time. I'm really looking forward to following, you know, how the album does, your career from afar in the UK, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and look, and for people who don't already know, where can they find Deep Cuts and where can they learn more about you?
Sure. KennyFosterMusic.com. We'll direct you everywhere you need to go. If you do the iTunes thing, you can do that. Also on your Instagram and your Twitter at Kenny Is Go.
Nice, excellent. And you can follow the show at Beyond the Pitch. You can follow me at Scott Nichols from the Bedford in Balham. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Check us out online at beyondthepitch.net. Follow us on Twitter at Beyond the Pitch, or find us on Facebook at Beyond the Pitch Show.